But the international level wanted countries around the world to establish retirement programs and medical programs for people. So Congress in 1934 came along and used its strongest constitutional power, the power to regulate and control interstate commerce. Based upon its interstate commerce powers, it imposed a scheme whereby the workers in the interstate industries were provided with, you know, the beginnings of a Social Security program. And of course, there was a related tax. And of course, the primary people, the companies that were involved in interstate commerce back in those days, the big ones were the railroad companies. So when Congress comes along and passes this Social Security program for interstate workers, you know, the railroad companies said, "Whoa, we got to sue." And they did. So Alta Railway filed a lawsuit against the Railroad Retirement Board, making all sorts of arguments about how that 1934 tax and program whereby the proceeds are used to benefit, you know, the interstate workers. You know, that was the challenge made in by Alton Railway when they sued the Railroad Retirement Board. So in the case quickly went to the United States Supreme Court. Here you have brand new legislation, extremely broad, brought on by the Great Depression. You know, here you have the first, basically the first benefits program at the federal level of major significance. So the Supreme Court takes this case, and in May 1935, the United States Supreme Court rules, and it holds this legislation unconstitutional. Now, let me read what is quoted here. "The catalog of means and actions which might be imposed upon an employer in any business tending to the satisfaction and comfort of his employees seems endless. Provision for free medical attendance and nursing, for clothing, for food, for housing, for the education of children, and 100 other matters might with equal propriety be proposed as tending to relieve the employee of mental strain and worry." Can it fairly be said that the power of Congress to regulate interstate commerce extends to the prescription of any and all of these things? Is it not apparent that they are really and essentially related solely to the social welfare of the worker and therefore remote from any regulation of commerce as such? We think the answer is plain. These matters obviously lie outside the orbit of congressional power. Now, this case has never been overruled. This is good law today. But we have that. How does it come about? Now, this decision came out in May 1935. The second round of Social Security legislation came out in August 1935. Now, I must remind our listeners that we did not have. Remember, when the 16th Amendment was passed, that was to address a problem created by in 1894 by a Supreme Court decision saying Congress didn't have this power. So we came along with an amendment. Well, now we don't even have an amendment. You know, the Supreme Court shoots down Social Security legislation. I mean, that's exactly what I've read off here in this quote. You cannot tell me that that isn't the essence of Social Security and all the socialist legislation. That's Social Security. But whereas with the 16th Amendment, you know, to address the problem created by the Supreme Court, here you have a problem created by the Supreme Court, but we don't need an amendment. In August of 1935, without an amendment, we come along with a second round of Social Security legislation. Now, down in Birmingham, Stuart Machine, see that Stuart Machine against Davis? Stuart Machine, you know, if you go from Birmingham, downtown Birmingham, up 559, heading toward northeast Alabama, Stuart Machine is still there on the northeast side of the interstate. So it's still around. So Stewart Machine was one of the parties, an Alabama company, that went to the Supreme Court dealing with the constitutionality of the second round of Social Security legislation. Now, once they passed in August of 1935, the second round of Social Security legislation, and once these lawsuits got started, they were ultimately also headed to the Supreme Court. As you can see, the sites, the sites to these cases are in 1937. One of them is the Stewart Machine Company, an Alabama case. But, you know, I've read the briefs in this second round of Social Security legislation, and the lawyers were not forgetful of the Supreme Court's decision that happened a mere 3 months before these laws were passed. The Alton Railway case. Arguments were built on that. And what are the lawyers for Stewart Machine and Helvering, what are they saying? You know, they're building arguments based upon the Alton Railway case. So here you have, you know, when you read the briefs and you can see the issues that are created, you know, I've got this little, simple little question in my mind. Well, where does the Supreme Court, in reference to an obvious issue, where does the Supreme Court address it? Now, I've gone through both Stewart Machine and Helvering against Davis. And let's see down here, which one is that, 641? Okay, so that'd be Helvering against Davis. So down here, here's something I want to note for our friends that are on this Zoom meeting. You know, I went through both Stewart Machine and Helvering and looking for, well, where did the Supreme Court address these issues? This issue I've seen that was raised in the briefs. Surely the Supreme Court's going to address, you know, 2 years after they render the May 1935 decision in Alton Railway, now they're dealing with the same issue all over again. Certainly they got to address this obvious issue. Well, the only place I can find where that is the case is in Helvering against Davis. When you sit down and you read it and you look through the decisions, looking for where in the world did the Supreme Court address this obvious issue? And I can only find, the only place where I can find any effort to address this, wow, big issue of dealing with constitutionality is this paragraph that's on the screen. And here's what the Supreme Court says. When such a contention comes here, we naturally require a showing that by no reasonable possibility can the challenged legislation fall within the wide range of discretion permitted to the Congress. Now, isn't that telling you, I mean, that's a fancy way of saying, well, we got to address this constitutional argument. And the way that they address the constitutional argument is not in so many words. They do it by referring you to some cases. So the answer to this, oh, it's unconstitutional, or gee, you know, how do you conform, you know, this recent legislation with the Supreme Court's decision in May 1935, that's unconstitutional, you know, in essence, the Social Security scheme. So here's what I've done. Here on the screen, you know, is this paragraph, and I've got links to the cases. So the Supreme Court cites United States versus Butler. So maybe that case is a part of this answer to our question of, well, how could this be constitutional? Oh, well, I don't think Butler tells you anything about, answers that question, how could it be constitutional? Because Butler dealt with and found Roaring 30s, the Great Depression legislation, socialist legislation. United States against Butler found some of that legislation unconstitutional. So the answer isn't there. Oh, but they're acknowledging, yeah, there are limits. There are limits and things can be unconstitutional. Well, then what about Cincinnati Soap? Oh, now Cincinnati Soap, that might be real important. You know what? Cincinnati Soap is a case dealing with a tax in the insular possessions. Oh, So when Congress, when the Supreme Court is saying, well, gee, of course it can be constitutional, and they cite Cincinnati Soap, I think that there's a, oh, that's a big answer to our question. And then the other case that I've got linked here, the head money cases. What does the head money cases say? It found constitutional the tax on aliens that were being brought to this country as they got off the ship. I think it was 50 cents a head or something like that. That's the head money cases. So here you have, you know, with the only spot in Helfrich against Davis where the United States Supreme Court addresses how can we resolve this second round of Social Security legislation? How do we resolve that with the Supreme Court saying it's unconstitutional in May 1935? Well, the Supreme Court is citing two of the cases that they cite right here. Head money cases deals with aliens. And then also Cincinnati Soap is a tax on the insured possessions. And gee, I think that that's kind of a big indicator. Now let's one other thing I want to point out here. And this is something that the tax movement doesn't know much about or has only a passing interest in, I think. But you know, with Social Security, you know, it's a tax, there are benefits. And, you know, when you sit there and try, if you were to compile and copy every Social Security decision at the appellate level here in America, you know, we'd have a, you know, enough copies to fill the floor of my office. You know, thousands, tens of thousands of cases dealing with Social Security. But only a handful of them would deal with, well, how's it constitutional? You know, nobody's raising these issues today. You know, here you've got, and nobody says anything about this. You know, this is not on anybody's radar screen, even though, you know, this is something I've been hooping and hollering about for 20 years, you know, 30 years, you know, Cincinnati Soap, head money cases, you know, how'd they have an effect in the Helfrich versus Davis case. Now, Joe, let's bring up that other PDF image that had those stuff dealing with treaties. And I just copied some real quick, but you know, the page of my website that we just had on the screen, that is from a brief where I talk about how treaties are used to expand the powers of Congress. You know, and it starts off with the migratory bird cases are real educational about how the treaty power of Congress works. You know, I've got a lot of material on that page. You know, people need to understand, you know, how treaties can operate. And you know, I would suggest to you that this whole thing about Social Security, you know, everybody thinks that it's so broad. But, you know, here are the foundational cases that deal with Social Security. Helfrich against Davis, Stewart Machine. Yeah, treaties, source for municipal power. But Joe, bring up, you know, we do have, this is something a lot of people don't understand. Bring up that PDF image, Joe. We have treaties. You know, not that I'm not saying that we've ratified these, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now you read this UN stuff. Oh man. You know, it's, you know, for, left wingers, oh, this is great stuff. You know, it's all this highfalutin language about we're going to do all this stuff for everybody, but it's it would establish it. If you want what the UN wants, we'd have a completely regulated society. But in any event, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 25 says everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, and other lack of livelihood and circumstances beyond his control. Oh, that looks so great. You know, International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Go down a little bit, Joe. This is a provision in it. the steps to be taken by the state's party to the present covenant to achieve the full realization of this right shall include those necessary for A, the provision for the reduction of the stillbirth rate and infant mortality and for the healthy development of the child. B, the improvement of all aspects of environmental and industrial hygiene. C, the prevention, treatment, and control of epidemic, endemic, occupational, and other diseases. And D, the creation of conditions which would assure to all medical service and the medical attention in the event of sickness. And of course, you know, it may very well be that, you know, this effort to bring in national health care is really treaty based. So I've said what I wanted to say tonight. I wanted to educate whoever was listening in tonight to two things. Number one, you need to look at the current events, this political theater that we're being, we're all absorbing every day of every week, every month, a whole year long, we absorb this political theater. We're being bombarded by these thoughts from the thought controllers. And they want to bring in right now, you know, they accomplished it with Obamacare, and now they want to bring in gun control. And the problem with both of those is that they've got some real substantial equal protection problems. These over-inclusive classifications. Everybody is needed to resolve this problem involving a minority. That's one point I wanted to make tonight. And then the other point I wanted to make tonight was to show y'all what's the real foundation for Social Security, something that a lot of people really haven't thought anything about. It's not the subject of popular discussion. So now, Joe, I've said my what I wanted to say. I've had my piece.
Thank you, Larry. We probably should have invited if anybody, we've already been picking on Peter a lot, but if anyone else wants to...
He's a likely target.
be unmuted and ask a question, but you feel free to chat the question too. Usually Gary's real good while we're blowing our hot air to keep an eye on the chat. So I'm having to kind of do it real time. And I don't know if Sean's still around too. No, looks like Sean had to leave. I don't really see any questions currently. Peter's still confused about the EP and its relation to over-inclusivity. So I don't know, could you, any other examples, Larry?
Really, I thought the examples I did give were demonstrative of the concept. You know, if you've got a problem, you know, a legislative body, which includes all the state legislatures, includes the Congress. When they're confronted with a problem, they've got to identify that problem. And their legislation has to be designed to address the problem. It is not designed to use a problem as an excuse for doing anything. You know, so if you do have a problem with, you know, if there's a problem in a state that's being caused by drunk drivers, then you pass legislation that will impact and address the problem of drunk drivers. However, you know, that legislation should not impose burdens upon the non-drug driving public.
Do you recall what
makes sense, Peter?
The Bowling case or Reed versus Reed or Shriners, Larry, like what were the facts and circumstances?
I really don't know. I've forgotten, but you know, okay. I just simply tonight, you know, I've got a long file on equal protection dealing with a lot of aspects. And I just went through there. Well, gee, where's a quote I can throw up?
Sure.
But you know, but like Shriners Hospital, you know, this is something that is, you know, when you dig into the cases dealing with equal protection, see down there, it's talking about over-inclusive and under-inclusive classifications. You know, I'm just not blowing smoke. You know, this is the terminology when you get into the equal protection field of study. You know, that's what they're talking about. Now, you know, I kind of thought it was kind of easy to understand, you know, that a legislative body's got to address a problem, it's got to direct its legislation at that problem. It can't then use an excuse of the excuse of drunk driving to impose obligations on the entire public which the vast majority of which is not causing any problems. They're not drunk drivers.
Right. Hey, Mike asked, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, were these cases the ones that caused FDR to threaten to pack the court, or do you remember what those cases?
Well, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, this would be, you know, what was going on right here was this is evidence of what was going on. You know, that battle with about packing the court, you know, you have some decisions, you know, like what we were talking about when we were reading that quote from Helbring against Davis. You know, they were citing to the decisions of the Supreme Court the Supreme Court was striking down a lot of this legislation of the 30s, the socialist legislation. Boom, it was being shot down. And then in response to that, that's when, you know, the pressure came on FDR. Hey, we're going to expand the court, and we're going to throw on some liberal judges, which is exactly what they're doing now. You know, there's been an amicus curiae brief filed here recently in some case. I don't know what it was about, but, you know, I saw a news article about some congressmen, some left-wing congressmen, in filing their own petition. Well, no, I don't know. They're not parties. They were filing something like a friend of the court brief in some other case. And therein, they talked about, you know, here these congressmen are submitting a friend of the court brief in some other case that I don't remember what it's about. But they were talking about, oh, gee, we're going to, you know, if you guys don't straighten out and fly right, we're going to pack the court. So they did it. And I think Ted Cruz raised some hell about that. You know, he talked about how in the world, how to have some congressmen. I think one congressman was a lawyer, so he could do it. You know, he knows how to do it. Well, I know how to do it in the sleep too, file a writ petition. You need somebody that can do a good print job. If you got that, it's a piece of cake. But you know, they were doing that there.
Comment, Larry, about DUI checkpoints and their relationship to equal protection?
Well, I don't think you would have, you know, you can see how, I think it's, you know, as you move up and down the scale of how legislation affects parties that are not a part of the problem, you know, you have some good clean areas and then some areas that are not so clean. So I would think that, you know, a city can, or a state can come along and easily justify, gee, you know, we've had, you know, they've come up with some statistics, you know, at this particular location, you know, we've had, you know, so many drunk drivers pass through. So, you know, we decided to come up with, here you're not necessarily dealing with legislation, you're dealing with actions. So you're not dealing with this particular equal protection problem at all when, you know, you're dealing with something like a roadblock that's set up that's not established by legislation. So that'd be an entirely different problem. You know, and this equal protection argument relates only to legislation. But, you know, that's enough because, you know, just Obamacare and, you know, this threat about gun confiscation or gun control, you know, they're using El Paso and Ohio and, you know, this other case that happened in Midland, you know, they're using that as an excuse. Oh, well, we need to take away everybody's guns. Nope. Try something else. We got a constitutional argument. He says you can't do that.
Like Richard comments, TSA is to prevent terrorists on planes, so everyone is presumed to be a terrorist.
Well, I've got this over my. I can't tell you that anything TSA does at the airports is legal. This is on my website someplace. You know, maybe go back over to that constitutional page, and I think down at the bottom that might have TSA. What TSA can do is invisible. I mean, all you've got in reference to laws. You know, back out of this. Back out of that. Okay, hit on constitutional and other legal materials. and go down toward the bottom. And I think TSA stuff is there. No. Yeah. Wow. When you take a look at the laws, 49 USC section 114, how did we create all this TSA stuff? And all you're dealing with is, well, some authority to fund. You know, it's not very much at all. I mean, the statutory authority for the TSA is so vague. You can't see that, you know. Go read this stuff, 49 USC section 5103, 49 USC 4901, 44902, you know, it's so blooming vague. And then when you get into the regulations, you know, the regulations, you know, here you have these broad, ill-defined statutes. And well, if you want to try to find something even more specific, you consult regulations, and there you are, the TSA regulations. I mean, I can't find out. There's nothing in law, nothing in the regulations that says what they're doing at the airports is authorized. But you know, I have a reason for this. At the federal level, control over airplanes, it's based on treaties. The subjects of treaties are aliens here, citizens abroad. And so if you have the subjects of a treaty are aliens here and citizens abroad, that doesn't include Americans at home. So treaty implementing federal legislation would not include citizens at home. Well, you know, this is my theory. I'm not going to try to say it's, you know, I've thoroughly researched it, but I can say, having looked into the treaty connection of Uncle Sam's control over airports, it comes from treaties we've been adopting with and adopting with other countries since the 20s. And of course, and when you sit down and you read those treaties, everything you see at the airport today, it's there in the treaties. Same thing with telecommunications. So I would say that, you know, since the TSA is really finding its authority, constitutional authority on Congress's power to adopt treaties, and there are treaties adopted for that purpose. And since treaties don't affect a domestic American, that may very well be one of the reasons why you don't find detailed regulations regarding what is going on with TSA at the airports. Now, do people understand that? Is that too convoluted, or do I need to explain it a little bit more?
I think you've got a lot of good detail here. Again, we're always trying to encourage people to do their homework. There's some homework here to do, but you've done a lot of work here. I didn't know you did all this on TSA.
Yeah. Well, it was hot, you know, but this is probably 10 years old, though. Now, somebody asked me about it one day, and I said, well, I don't know. I hadn't looked at it. You know, nobody had ever caused me to think about looking at TSA, so I did it. You know, I spent maybe about a day looking into it, and that's the conclusion I drew.
Let's. We're going to unmute Peter again, because I guess he'll tell us, but...
Okay, so Larry, tell me if this is correct. So when I read the 14th Amendment, Section 1, second sentence says the following: no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, unquote.
Right.
Okay, so...
That's the Equal Protection Clause.
Right. Okay, so when they pass a law that's overly broad to address a problem, then I'm being denied my privileges and rights because I'm not part of the problem. Is that how the equal
Peter, this is when you're getting into stuff like this, you know, all it talks about is the principle in the 14th Amendment, equal protection. What is that? Well, the courts have had to deal with that for, you know, 100 years, 150 years, and they have been doing it. You know, here a decision is made about what is equal protection. There a decision is made about what is equal protection. So over time, the courts have developed the parameters of what in the world does equal protection mean? And so they've done so. So as a part of, you know, this topic known as equal protection is this concept. Equal protection, you know, deals with classifications. And a lot of legislation deals with classifications. And, you know, the courts have come along and said, well, you know, if just part of the development of the concepts of equal protection over 150 years, they have ultimately the refined essence of a whole bunch of cases is this, that, you know, a legislative body, when it is enacting legislation to address a problem, they got to focus in on the problem. They can't use that problem as an excuse for doing something else. If they're using it as an excuse for doing something else, then that's overbroad legislation. Or then, let's say that a problem's created by all redheaded men in a state. And then, you know, to address that problem, the legislature comes along and says, oh, well, you know, all the redheaded men in this in our state are causing problems. So therefore, we're going to pass this law that's going to apply to redheaded men over the age of 50. This law only applies to them. Well, then in that situation, that's an under-inclusive classification. So, you know, these arguments, all I can say, instead of getting into a long analysis of cases and dealing with the facts in cases, you know, it's better to just deal with principles.
Okay, so the principle of over-inclusivity or under-inclusivity is what came out of these years and years of case law around the 14th Amendment, and that is the connection between the inappropriateness of these laws to the 14th Amendment.
Right, right.
All right, now I got it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, all right, okay, well, I'm glad
you saw it. It wasn't clear to me that the over-inclusivity and under-inclusivity was a product, if you will, a principle that was derived from the 14th Amendment, but I see it is now based on what you said.
Yeah, okay. All right. From Mike, but in the end, a judge gets to decide and we all have to live by his opinion.
The story of Larry's life. Huh.
Question mark. I'll pass on answering that question for right now.
Well, unless there's anybody else that wants to chat real quick that they really want to speak, we're probably going to wrap it up for tonight. What I'll do while you're deciding if you want to chat to speak is just go over the websites. The benefit for this is mostly people that may watch later. But, of course, we encourage everyone to spread the word, those people that do enjoy these programs live. Sean O'Connor, who was with us briefly, you can go to seanoconnor.org. And Gary Thomason, who couldn't be with us tonight, he said he might try, but he was having some various difficulties. So we wish him well. But you, Gary doesn't have a website, but you can email him, Gary, G-A-R-Y, at npn.net. That's Nancy Paul Nancy, npn.net. And Larry's website that we've been spending quite a bit of time at. Did I lose that already? Well, we'll do it again. We'll watch, show everybody. I know the routine listeners are maybe tired of this. Go to startpage.com, type in BCraft Briefs. And you can see right there, BCraft Briefs is what you choose. Takes you to the Dixieland Law Journal.
Yeah, but if you notice that also, they usually have the advertisements for underwear above that.
Right. Skip the Fruit of the Loom ads and find the real good stuff here at the Dixieland Law Journal. Then my website, agentfortruth.com. I always like to point out to people that at the radio show tab, if I'm late to, or in this case today, not even getting an email out to my email list, you can always go to the radio show tab and see the link to the show that we're doing that particular Wednesday night. It's right there. That would take you to, maybe some of the listeners and viewers actually use that. So that's there. And then beneath, of course, we have the past shows that I slowly get here as archives. And once again, it really helps us if you watch the videos, even if you were here live for the show, watch the show again once it's uploaded. Tell other people about the show so that they can watch them. You know, you can, the nice thing about an archive show is you can pause it, grab your coffee, say hi to your wife or husband, and you know, get back to your homework when you get a chance. So we really encourage people to go here and view the archives of the videos. So let's just check one more time for anybody that had any last comments. Mike had his comment about the judge gets to decide. Mike is saying, can you get me a contact number for Sean? You know, I don't know if on Sean's website he gives a phone number. Let's see.
I'm gonna roll, Joe.
There you go. Has everybody seen that? You can, at the bottom of Sean's website at seanoconnor.org. He's got his address, phone number, and email address. So that should take care of business for Mike. All right. Well, we appreciate everybody. I guess, Peter, if you're still unmuted, any last comments from you?
I'm good, Joe. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks to everybody who's always religiously coming to see us do our thing every Wednesday. And we hope to see you next week. And we'd ask you to bring more visitors, bring more viewers, because we'd like to reach as many people as possible. Thanks to everyone. God bless. And we'll see you next Wednesday.